Week in Retronauts, a small change of pace as we have more micro-episodes than we have space in our schedule for. Instead of just holding onto these for months, decided to put them together into a single double episode. Please enjoy.
This Week in Retronauts, absolute karate. That's Kyo Coogan, and don't forget it, Dweebenheimer. Everyone, and welcome to a Retronauts micro recorded in a noisy hotel in, where the hell are we?
Gardens County?
Unionville, New York.
Actually, the outside is noisy, not the inside.
That's true. The hotel itself is quite quiet, but there's a bunch of bros and muscle cars. Actually, someone corrected me. They're supercars. It's like, you know, $100,000 plus Lamborghinis and stuff. Using those cars as they were intended and driving at about 35 miles per hour around in a parking lot. That was just what Enzo wanted when he created his Ferrari.
I'd be okay if they were funny cars, but there's nothing funny about
them. Man,
this.
They were like fire-breathing funny cars. Yeah. Can you imagine?
No nitros being burned today.
No. It's not Sunday yet. So anyway, hi, I am Jeremy Parrish. And with me, of course, you recognize the dulcet tones of none other than Bob Mackey.
Hello, I'm going to disappoint everybody on this podcast. Please tweet at me.
And special guests, since we're in New York, which is adjacent to New Jersey.
Kurt Collada.
Of?
Hardcore Gaming 101.
And?
This is Rob Russo, or Xerxes, from the Hardcore Gaming 101's podcast.
That has a name, right?
It's, well, it had an old name, and now it's called the Top 47,858 Games of All Time.
So I haven't really been listening to your podcast because it's nothing personal. I don't ever have time to listen to podcasts. So why 47,000?
Well, I wanted an arbitrary number, and when I typed in games in Moby Games, that's how many results it had.
So you're covering every game.
Theoretically.
As of the point that you started your podcast.
Yeah, which was about a year ago. We're maybe about 0.001% done. We just did ranked our 200th game. So the way it works is that people nominate games one way or another, usually through like, you know, five-star review on something because we're whores. and they nominate a game and then we will rank it in comparison to other games we've ranked. And in fact, I got this idea from another podcast by one Chris Sims, who was just on your show. He did one. And so I stole it directly from him, but his is about comic books, which I know nothing about. So, I thought, what if I did something about games? And the joke is that it's totally scientific and not arbitrary at all. But
right, of course. As all rankings of objective or subjective matter should be.
Yeah.
And Kurt, tell us a little bit about the history of Hardcore Gaming 101. It's been around a long-ass time.
2003-ish, I think. It was something that I started in college, kind of.
You've been online doing stuff before that, though. You were doing stuff in the 90s.
97 was the official date that I started the Castlevania Dungeon back when I was in high school. And I kept doing that up mostly through college, or at least through high school. But after a while, it just kind of gets boring writing about Castlevania.
Does it?
Well, at that point, they were bringing out, like, maybe a new game a year, which, you know, you focus on that.
And what was that like? A new Castlevania game every year? Tell me about the good old days, Dad.
There was pluses and minuses, because at the same time, there was one every year. But at the same time, they did kind of get very samey after
That's
a while.
That's true.
Which is...
you've played one Castlevania Judgment. You've played them all.
But, I mean, nowadays, it's almost better, because you get Castlevania-like games, but... in different contexts, like you know, Guacamelee or Axiom Verge or stuff like that, that basically fills in that without actually being a Castlevania game. But yeah, I'd start doing that, and then I did a Contra website, which I forgot about at some point. And then I decided to sort of take the idea of like a fan site, but condense them smaller, and that was where Hardcore Gaming 101 came from.
It's too bad we don't have just like the whole weekend to record here, because we could probably get you to do a pretty kick-ass Contra episode with us, but it's not on the agenda. Instead, what we're talking about this week is, in this micro episode, The King of Fighters, which I know very little about. I played some of The King of Fighters back in the 90s and tried to wrap my head around their mechanics, and was like, this isn't Street Fighter. I don't understand. I'm not capable in my lizard brain of understanding more than one fighting game's schematic. But the series has just kept on going, and it's up to, what, number 16 now?
14 of the numbered entries.
I thought it was 16. Okay, sure.
So do you no longer use the years when you refer to them? Do you refer to, like, 97 is 3 or 4, or how does that work?
It would everybody get confused.
Okay.
Yeah, beginning with the... Yeah, I mean, it was confusing at the time because you had, like, you know, a game released in the arcades in, like, 1997 coming out for PlayStation in 1999 or 2000.
Yeah.
And it was still called 97. People were like, it's 2000. Why do I want to buy King of Fighters 97?
But somebody, before we started recording, said King of Fighters 12.
Yeah.
And what does that mean?
So at a certain point, they switched over. I think 2003 had both naming conventions.
No, 2003 was the last one on the Neo Geo.
Okay.
So then they moved to the Atomos Wave, where they created a game called Neo Wave, which doesn't count among the number entries. And then they made 11, which was for the Atomos Wave.
Okay.
And then they changed over because they were at the point, they're like, we can't make these yearly anymore.
I kind of like the idea of, like, a King of Fighters, like, aught 9 or, like, King of Fighters 13. Like, oh, it's like 1913. It could be, like, really... But it's not. It's just
it was a
doing a dust
problem.
Up in the boiler works.
Put up your dukes.
Yep.
Fisticuffs.
They actually renamed one of the King of Fighters 98 when they brought it out for the Dreamcast in America. They called it King of Fighters 99, and they gave it some sort of subtitle, which was confusing because there was an actual King of Fighters 99,
right,
which they gave a different subtitle when they brought the Dreamcast.
Yeah, I remember I was kind of following the series at that point, and I remember it just being kind of a mess in terms of the numeration. So it's good that they switched to the numbers.
Yeah.
But it also does sort of denote a change in eras. You know, there was the SNK years for Neo Geo, and then SNK was bought out by
Playmore. Yeah, I don't
was
know
it Playmore?
How it quite worked, like, corporate structure wise. Like, SNK sort of reassembled as.
But there
Playmore.
Was like Aruze or whatever. Where did they come in? Yeah, they came in first. And tried to turn SNK and, like, all their properties into gambling and, like, pachinko machines.
What a pipe dream. That'll never work.
They supposedly killed off the Neo Geo Pocket Color so they could use the screens for their pachinko machines or something. And then Playmore came in.
There was no erotic art of fighting pachinko?
Not yet. Okay. Maybe Konami can step in and help with that, though.
There is a King of Fighters dating game series. There are 9 episodes and 3 DS games.
Wow, okay. So,
is it like Doki Doki King of Fighters?
No, it's compared to that stupid witch touching game, it's like pretty straightforward.
Oh, geez, I didn't mean like that. I just like, you know, like Doki Doki, like my heart's pounding.
No, it's kind of resets the entire universe and recasts all the characters. Like, I think East Howard in one of them is a principal, and like Mai Shiranui is your sexy next door neighbor.
No Kusanagi in the history of South Town has ever amounted to a hill of beans.
It practically writes itself. This is
I know, right?
Well, my perspective on these games that I really don't know a lot about is I did like fighting games. I like Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, but these SNK things were kind of inaccessible. So for me and a lot of other friends, I think we watched the anime that they brought over first, and we wondered what these games were. I mean, you would read about them,
that
but
girl has such bouncy breasts.
They did like to animate. What
what is this fighting game about?
Yeah, was it Mai who has the breasts? Okay, yes. Jeremy's now ashamed that he said that, I guess. But yeah, I mean, I feel like that could be why I'm not as tapped into these games. Is that of course I could have always accessed them later, but when I was into fighting games, they were kind of hard to play.
No, actually, I remember Mai just because back, you know, when I was buying anime on VHS, they like all the animes had an intro trailer before you could actually watch the 30 minutes of content that you paid for. And they were always advertising Fatal Fury, the motion picture. And that was one of the images they were very proud of, was her like flinging her fan forward and her body kind of continuing to vibrate for
just
several seconds afterwards.
That's what Japanimation's all about.
Yep.
1994.
we should probably back up and like kind of talk about how.
We should, because I mentioned the two words, the secret words, Fatal Fury.
Yeah. Okay, so go.
Yeah, I had to look up the history about this, but Fatal Fury was, what was the guy's name? He would have been with the industry forever. He had worked at IRAM and created Moon Patrol.
Yeah, Takashi Nishiyama.
Yeah, he created Moon Patrol and Kung Fu Master.
Yep.
And then at some point he left for SNK, and one of the first games, well, I don't know if it was the first one, was Fatal Fury, which is also subtitled King of Fighters in some versions. And it's sort of thought to be a Street Fighter 2 ripoff, but it's actually supposed to be a Street Fighter 1 ripoff. Hmm. Because he had worked for Capcom, and he's one of the main guys who created the original Street Fighter. So that was his way to sort of compete with that. That's kind of one of the reasons why in the Fatal Fury, there's only three playable characters. The Terry Bogard, Andy Bogard, and Joe Higashi.
Because it's going back to more of the, like, you're just playing as Ryu style.
Yeah. Oh, and they were all kind of, they all had their different type of moves. But one of the main gimmicks behind that was that two players could play at once against a CPU character. Didn't work in practice at all, but it was just something that set it apart from, at that point, Street Fighter 2.
Now, I know, Kurt, you just said that it's like it probably wasn't intended as a Street Fighter 2 knockoff, but I always think of SNK in this period, like maybe that period or shortly thereafter, as kind of like specializing in like boutique knockoffs for their own hardware. And by boutique knockoffs, I mean they're technically like, this is what they're going for, this is the trend, but we're going to do it our way and we're going to make it look really good on our hardware, and it's going to be the thing. So they've got, you know, their fighting games are, of course, like, you know, they've got characters in all of these games that are basically just Street Fighter characters. And I could probably think of another example if I had written
well,
it down.
That gets into Art of Fighting, which is kind of the legendary ripoff. Because after Fatal Fury, Fatal Fury 2 was definitely more of a competing directly with Street Fighter 2, because all the characters had different world locations, even though it didn't really make any sense in the context of the story. And I forget when it came out, but the other main series they brought was Art of Fighting. Mm-hmm. The main gimmick of that was the gigantic characters and the scaling, which became representative of a lot of Neo Geo.
And that was where they introduced the idea of like layers, sort of like, you know, the front layer, the back layer.
Yeah,
that was Fatal Fury.
Was that?
Yeah, okay. That had that too. There's actually three layers that you could sort of shift between. And that was one of those things that, again, didn't really work all that much. Like, yeah, later games actually kind of got rid of that.
Like, Virtua Fighter, I think, was the first to make that work, and it made more sense with 3D because, you know, the idea of sidestepping aside from a projectile. Like, yeah. I get that's what they were going for with these, but I've played, you know, the older, I guess it was Fatal Fury that tried that. I was just like, it doesn't quite communicate in 2D, and it's a little overly complicated. I think if they had just two layers, it might have worked better, but having the three layers, it's really frustrating. Like, I can't use it to good effect, but the CPU sure can.
Yeah, it's in the earlier games, it was a pain because you didn't just like shift between them, but you actually like jumped between them and people would, like, face each other, and you could sort of deliver.
You
like,
could hit each other as you jumped past each other.
But it felt like it ruined the flow of the game, I thought, a little bit. And by the time the later ones, like, they sort of rebooted it as the real Fatal Fury series, which was a little bit more like Street Fighter Alpha, like a little bit cartoonish. And by the time they got to Garo, Mark of the Wolves, all of that was gone.
Well, that's like way.
Yeah, that's competing with Street Fighter 3, so that was much later down the line.
So with King of Fighters, I guess like that was apparently not supposed to be a crossover deliberately, but there was just an idea of like, let's just take, we've got all these characters, let's like put them in a. Do you know how they came up with that idea? Like,
they had started doing crossovers at some point. I think it was Fatal Fury Special that as a secret character had Ryo Sakazaki from Art of Fighting. And then Art of Fighting 2, they had Geese Howard. But like Art of Fighting and Fatal Fury, even though they take place in the same canon, they're actually different timelines. Like the Art of Fighting games take place in the 80s. So when they had Geese Howard and he's like young and has long hair instead of having the like the buff and the Hakama.
Classic Geese, yeah.
So at some point they decided that to combine these series. Although weirdly enough, like they're in entirely different canons.
Well,
okay. That's where it starts getting confusing because they both focus on the city of Southtown, which Geese Howard had, I think, killed Terry Bogard's father, and then there's a whole big revenge thing of that. And he technically ended up dying at the end of the first Fatal Fury. Like, if you watch the intro to Garo, Mark of the Wolves, they show this really dramatic scene where they're fighting at the top of Geese Tower, I think it's called, and Terry Bogard knocks him off.
Not Howard Tower.
And Terry grabs him, and Geese is like, I'm not going to be at your mercy, and just lets himself go and plummets to the ground. So for a while, they were operating under the premise that Geese Howard had died in this continuity. They brought him back. They were like, oh, he fell. He survived. But in certain games, he's there as like an angel or a zombie or just whatever weird context that they could do. But anyway, going to the King of Fighters thing, they aged up the Art of Fighting characters to match where the Fatal Fury ones were. And they also, Geese Howard is still alive in this timeline. Which is like all ultimately, it sounds unimportant, but like one of the big things about King of Fighters is just how they build up all these characters and the weird little relationships they have, and how they like actually pay attention to it in the context of these games, which is really kind of bizarre.
How did they do that early on when the games are kind of like didn't have as much? Like right now, when you play like, say, King of Fighters 13, there's like before every match, there's like a nice little like repartee between the characters, and you get an idea of like how the characters relate to each other that way. But in the first ones, right, it was just kind of the win quotes and like a couple ending scenes.
And it was the win quotes, and like every in certain games, they would have little pre-fight animations, but they didn't really have much to them. They're very short, and they didn't have any text to them either. Like they would just speak in Japanese, so a lot of that was lost in the English-speaking audience because there is so much King of Fighters tie-in merchandise. Like if you look at the Japanese Wikipedia article, there's drama CDs, there's comics, there's light novels. Weirdly, there wasn't an anime until much later. Like they had the Fatal Fury and Art of Fighting animes. But a lot of that was fleshed out with supplementary material, which of course we never got and may not have cared about anyway.
Besides Mai, like were there breakout characters?
Kyo Kusanagi, which is one of the original characters that they created for King of Fighters, and his rival, Yuri Agami, which I always thought was a really stupid character design. Like, before I got into King of Fighters...
That's interesting you say that. Go ahead.
We used to go to Chinatown a lot because my college was pretty close to it in New York City. And they had, like, the bootleg poster section. You get, like, 5 posters for $10, and they had all sorts of different things. And I guess they really played up those two characters, aiming them towards the yaoi fangirls, which was very strange.
Yeah, Yuri was always kind of sort of key example of the stylistic approach that SNK took with its characters. I mean, Street Fighter is a pretty motley rabble. You've got the dudes in the gis, and then you've got, you know, Chun-Li, who's wearing something that's kind of like a traditional Chinese dress, but sort of modified for combat. And, you know, Sagat is a Muay Thai kickboxer. And so everyone's kind of like sort of real martial arts. And then it starts to get a little weirder as you get into like Street Fighter Alpha.
Yeah.
But yeah, King of Fighters and Art of Fighting, it's pretty much just like dudes in street clothes. And the street clothes start to become more stylish and more fashionable. And you start to get more like, no one's actually going to fight in an outfit where their legs are bound together with like a
bandana or something. Yeah. Yeah, that's Yuri.
But they, you know, it definitely helped the SNK games really stand apart, I think, from all the other competitors, because you either had like sort of the like elaborate fighting style, you know, real world martial arts outfits of Street Fighter, or just like, what the hell are these people even, like, these bizarre characters, these, like, arcane suits of armor and stuff like that of the lesser series. But then you had, you know, like, it almost feels like SNK was designing these games for cosplayers. Like, these are cool-looking characters who you want to go dressed as for Tokyo Game Show or Comic-Con.
I can definitely sort of see that. And they got more bizarre as they went along. At some point, they got this is one character artist, Falcoon, who I think was kind of one of those wannabe fashion designers.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was actually one of the main designers for the 3D spinoff, mm-hmm. Maximum Impact. And there was a whole lot of alternate costumes that he had designed. And they're really weird. Like, he actually created like a self-insert character that was a girl.
A girl? Yeah. A gorilla?
No, a girl.
Okay.
I forget her name. I think she was Korean or something like that.
Huh. Interesting.
But going back to the basis of King of Fighters, in addition to bringing together Art of Fighting and Fatal Fury, they also brought in the two characters from the Ikari Warriors series, mm-hmm. Ralph and Clark. And then Psycho Soldier.
Yeah.
Athena and Kensu. And Athena was actually from the previous game, Athena, mm-hmm. like the goddess. but she had been recast as a Japanese pop idol.
Right. So, and Kensu had been around because he showed up in Crystallis.
He was,
he was like a minor character. So he had been around before that because that was Athena from Psycho and Kensu. Okay, was he?
Both Athena and...
Is he like the prince, the captured prince who has to be rescued by Athena?
Actually, yeah.
Was he? He was. I know he's the second player in Psycho Soldier because he's a... I don't know if he's in the original Athena.
I don't think he is. I think he comes from Psycho Soldier, but it's not really... You don't need to understand any of this to play. Like, I don't know how any of that factors into the...
Yeah, none at all.
They change what Athena is, like, they frequently, now that they can... Now that they're not using the same sprites over and over. But, like, she was... Apparently, they really wanted her in, like, a schoolgirl uniform for a while, and SNK refused to do it because they thought it would hurt the game's, like, appeal in the United States, which is, like, you've got, like... 90 characters in this game, like they'll right. just pick then, the one they like.
Right, and I assume they saw Sakura from Street Fighter Alpha and were like, oh, okay, I guess it does work.
Well, I assume the Ikari Warriors don't fight with machine guns?
No, they have rapid fire, like one of the guys can like punch sort of like a Fist of the North Star character and make them explode. One of the
they
ones
have a special Micronics attack that makes the frame rate chug 20 per second.
Oh, there was actually this is a tangent, but the Neo Geo Battle Coliseum game, I think she, one of the main characters had an attack that could glitch something.
Oh, yeah.
I may have dreamed that. I can't remember.
The Battle Coliseum games were weird, so I would totally believe it. I mean, you've got, like, the Metal Slug aliens and stuff.
Yeah, that's when, like, the King of Fighters game sort of kept it really localized in the series that they were taking from. Like, Samurai Shodown was one of their other big characters, but they're like, we can't feature any of these samurais right. because that was too ridiculous. Except for King of Fighters 14, they're just like, screw it, Nakaruru's in.
Was that a continuity thing because Samurai Shodown is an early 20th century game or something like that?
It's much earlier.
Yeah, okay. It's like, yeah, it's set way before King of Fighters.
Right, right.
So yeah, I think despite the retconning involved with Geese, there was, like, story is actually super important to the King of Fighters series. It's the most fascinating thing about the series to me. It's just, like, how elaborate and arcane the story has become. So I can see where they would be like, no, we got to keep it, you can't bring a 19th century samurai into South Town.
That's just crazy.
1998.
Yeah. But they have, like, a magical, like, we have Athena who's, like, has magic powers for some reason, and
well, she's a psycho soldier.
She's a psycho, so like time travel shouldn't really be beyond the realm of possibility. I think it's has, or they could have had like a relative of like so and so.
I mean, I feel like they actually had the like some sort of contrivance to get the Samurai Shodown characters built in there as soon as they opened up the Orochi saga, because you have basically. Like the whole story for three games built around the idea of a character who's like the modern day manifestation of the Yamato no Orochi, the legendary eight-headed serpent who is defeated with the three mythical treasures of Japan. So why not just like have,
the American Ukyo
or someone fall forward in time? It's fine, guys. But okay, sure. Yeah, they tried to keep it at least a little... constrained to reality, quote unquote, in the mainline King of Fighter games for most of the time.
King of Fighter games as kind of, they're oddly grounded in a way that Street Fighter just never was post Street Fighter 2. Like in Street Fighter 2, you've got like, the guy does yoga and he's got a yoga fighting style. And because yoga people are flexible, he can stretch his arms all the way across the screen. They just don't do stuff like that in King of Fighters. Mm-hmm. Like there are some like projectile attacks, like, Kyo has his fire and Iori has his other fire, I guess.
Purple fire. Which he loses at one point.
I think.
Yeah, there's some version of the game where he loses his powers and doesn't have those attacks, and then gets it back.
His legs are still tied together, though, right?
Yeah.
That's the important part.
It's got to be his handicap.
Yeah. So, but it sticks very close to, like, rather than having all these, like, fanciful styles, like, it is more like there are, like, multiple Taekwondo characters, multiple Muay Thai fighters, multiple, karate fighters and stuff like that.
And they're like, some of them are like, they invent like dojos that they come from. And there's the, what's that guy's name? Mr. Karate. And
yeah. Oh yeah. That's the father of the Sakazakis. Ryo and Yuri.
I'll pretend like I, yeah.
Well, he's also called Mr. Karate. He was one of the bosses from Art of Fighting and he has a Tengu mask. And
yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And he has some sort of connection to Dan Hibiki in the crossover games, right?
Yeah, because Dan Hibiki from Street Fighter is a parody of both Ryo Sakazaki and Robert Garcia. Like, they just kind of meshed the two characters together and gave him a purple gi to sort of make fun of him. And I think in Marvel versus Street Fighter, like, the ending kind of parodies one of those games.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Hmm. Yeah, so like, we kind of wandered off track here a little bit, but...
it's really hard to stay focused.
Yeah, I mean, it is a sprawling series. So you mentioned Garo, Mark of the Wolves.
Yeah.
That was one of the later games. That was like when that came out on Dreamcast at the very end, it was like, I can't believe I have a game system at home with graphics, 2D graphics this beautiful. It was amazing looking. How does that fit into King of Fighters, though? I mean, there's Art of Fighting and Fatal Fury and like the Battle Coliseum and the crossovers and King of Fighters, but then there's other stuff like that.
It's still, that one is still operating on one of the Fatal Fury timelines, so it's technically separate, but by the time King of Fighters 11 came out, they finally decided to start integrating characters from that game to it. Like, Terry Bogard gets his outfit from that game where he's right. in the bomber jacket and the longer hair.
Well, Garo is about, like, a major character is Geese Howard's son, right?
Yeah, like, it goes off the premise that Geese Howard died, and Terry Bogard is all guilt-stricken. And he finds Geese Howard's orphan son, so he raises him. And it takes place like 10 years where he's an angsty teenager. And Rock has the abilities of both Terry and his father. And because of the time skip, a lot of the characters in Mark of the Wolves are either trainees or sons of the characters from Fatal Fury. Because the only returning character, I think, is Terry.
Mm-hmm.
So you have one of the characters, Kushnood Butt, who they've renamed. He has a different name in Japan. Or like,
why on earth would they do that?
He's basically one of the Kyokugen guys, like Yuri and Vio. And one of the characters is, I think, sort of like Mai, or sort of like Andy, Hokutomaru, I can't remember.
Would he be their progeny?
Like? Yeah, something like that, because he's missing. And there's two sons of Kim Kafwan. There's the Goody Two-Shoes and then the Rebel, and they both have like basically his style, but slightly different.
And he's a Korean character, right?
Yeah, he's a Korean Taekwondo fighter
right.
from Fatal Fury. Mm. And since they kind of kept these separate for whatever reason, they just for a long time walled off Garo from King of Fighters until King of Fighters 11 when they brought in, what's her name? It's the girl with the, I don't know, whatever. They brought in, I can't remember her name.
There are 5,000 characters.
Yeah. Hokuto? No, it's not Hokuto. She starts with an H. Anyway, they brought in T-Zok, which is the hawk guy wrestler. Yeah, he's pretty cool. Gato and who else did they bring in? Bijane, which is like my favorite character from that game because she's like a
crazy. Is she a pirate or something?
Yeah, she's a pirate lady.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's really cool.
I know a lot of these characters, not from the King of Fighters games, but from the Neo Geo Pocket spinoffs, especially like Gals Fighters and Match the Millennium, because those were like, those played so well and they were a lot more, to me, accessible than some of the, like, they didn't expect you to be quite as immersed in the systems as the Neo Geo games.
They were easy to play because they need to be portable. Mm-hmm. And the Neo Geo Pocket Color had a really good, like, clicky joystick for that sort of stuff that worked uncannily well.
It's kind of hard to explore the series because it goes off in so many different directions. And I say this before we've done the Dragon Slayer thing, but it might be easier to maybe talk about, like, focus on some of the, like, more interesting characters or, like, some of the more interesting changes between the games. Or
actually, maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the mechanics. Like, what makes King of Fighters distinct from, like, a Street Fighter series? That's the part that I have the hardest time wrapping my heads around. My head around, because it's like I pick up a King of Fighters game and they look and even kind of control like Street Fighter, but nothing works the way I expect it to, and it's really difficult for me to kind of get a feel for what the series wants from me. And I know like there's the team element and combos work differently, and of course. SNK boss has become like a derogatory cliche for a ridiculously difficult final boss.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you guys could offer some insights into that, but then maybe we could circle back to talk some more about the characters. But I do think that's an important aspect of the series.
It is, but I probably am not qualified to really get into that. I'm not like a super fighting
lack
game.
Of qualifications has never disqualified anyone from
talking on Retronauts.
Talking about things on Retronauts.
Well, I mean, the thing about that I think there's different things to appreciate about King of Fighters, and one of them might be the mechanics. I have a feeling that a lot of the feel of playing a King of Fighters game compared to playing a Street Fighter game is really influenced by the fact that it was on the same hardware for like how many years?
Over about a decade.
Yeah. So it's on the same hardware and it just keeps coming out, and the sprites don't change from 96 onward until
everyone is more again.
King of Fighters 12 was when they finally redid everybody.
They try and like cheat it by like shading the sprites differently using like, you know, just, but it all, it they're the same sprites. And,
I do have to say that SNK did amazing work at like just pulling out details and, you know, the illusion of abilities with the Neo Geo hardware that you never would have thought possible. Like they got some life out of that system.
Definitely. And that's like, so one of the ways to appreciate King of Fighters, even if you're not a super hardcore into fighting games, would just be to like to appreciate the quality of the sprite artwork and how like they could get just like incrementally better animations is also a big deal. Mm-hmm. And so there's that aspect to it.
Yeah, I mean, but as the cart capacity grew, then you started to see elaborate background animations, and like basically it's almost like they would, you know, take video stills and digitize those.
Oh yeah, that was their office was in Osaka, I believe, mm-hmm. By the Osaka train station. Mm-hmm. So I think in almost every entry, there's like a battle that takes place from a different angle of that train station, at least awesome. For a number of years.
Yeah.
There's I lost my train of thought. I'm thinking about trains. I'm thinking about Osaka. I wonder whether like some of the way it feels different than Street Fighter has to do with like the sprites are kind of, they're on the smaller side.
I think because they have so many characters, they're a little bit smaller, and the animation isn't quite as much compared to Garou: Mark of the Wolves, which is like, along with Street Fighter 2, one of like the high marks of fighting game sprite animation. So it feels a little bit stiffer than something like Street Fighter.
They really
did. And also I think the art style and some of the character design, specifically like the clothes they're wearing, I think that kind of lends to that stiffer feel. I don't know how to explain it, but
yeah, it's hard to but like the language
like Yori's outfit, you know, it seems very starched, I guess, for lack of a, like high collar and like stiff pants. So yeah, everyone does seem a little bit, I wouldn't say jerky, just a little stiffer, but not necessarily in a bad way. Just like it seems very deliberate and it's universal.
Yeah, you're not seeing like a lot of like the intricate animations of like clothes kind of flapping around. Yeah. Now other things except flap around. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I mean, but what's interesting is you really want to compare like where the sprite art was. Like you can look at SNK or Capcom v SNK 2, where they had to Capcom would redraw the sprites. And the first time I played it, I was like, wow, I didn't realize King of Fighters really was ripping off the Capcom style. You know, oh, no, wait, they redrew them. So like that. And then there's SNK made SVC Chaos,
yeah,
where they redrew Street Fighter characters. And they're kind of like more like Neo Geo.
Like they did put like a very distinct type of dithering shading, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's a more limited color palette. So
they've really ran into serious memory limitations as that series progressed. You can tell because in the very first one, in King of Fighters 94, they're like every stage has this cool like intro animation where it's like, you know, you're going past like a wall or like doors are opening or something, gates closing, or every single one of them. And as they go on, that happens less and less. Mm. The final stages usually have something cool. Like one of the final stages is like on an aircraft carrier or something like that. And like an inside, like some kind of, it's like the inside of a battleship, like the bridge of a battleship, but it's got like all this like rich guy, like gold, you know, I would say Trump-esque decoration to it. And it's really little things like that that I think make it stand out.
But since they were making a new game every year, like the core of it kind of stayed the same. There are always characters that you usually count on reappearing. Mm-hmm. But they also changed some of the baseline mechanics as it went along a little bit, especially starting in 99, where they looked at, I think Marvel vs. Capcom was probably at that time, and they borrowed what they called strikers.
Yeah.
Where you still have three characters, and you'd pick a fourth one who you could do a quick command, and then they'd come out and do an attack. And they really ramped that up in King of Fighters 2000, where there's almost – there's a ton of strikers that they just grabbed from different other SNK games. Like, they really brought the SNK fan service up to that one, where they brought in characters from Robot Army. They brought in, like, a discarded design for Kill before he was a real thing. Just so much bizarre stuff that they brought in just for fun.
Yeah, the team element is something that really sort of stands out in King of Fighters. And that started with the first one, right? But you had like a preset team. You couldn't choose individual characters and build your own team. You had to just like go with the trio that they gave you.
And they were arbitrarily assigned to weird countries too. Like,
yeah, at the time. That's when they still
was that like a Street Fighter 2 thing? Like, well, Thailand.
Yeah.
It's like Mexico. And then it's like, who's in Mexico? Like,
I don't think they're
it, oh, it's like Brazil. Ikari it's team. Like Brazil is the Ikari Warriors. I'm like, Ralph and Clark, okay.
I guess they were fighting through the jungles of Brazil.
Sure. I don't really want to know what Ralph and Clark were up to down there. There's some like Soldier of Fortune magazine type stuff right. going on there.
But they're always divided into teams in all the King of Fighters games. There's of three of them. And they actually change in the entries about who was paired up with which character. And in the King of Fighters 94, they need to be, you always pick like those three characters. And in later ones, you can mix and match. But if you cared about the storyline, then you had to play as a team because they were the ones that would give unique endings.
Mm. So you had to have like the sort of canonical characters for the proper interactions. Otherwise, it was just like you're just fighting.
Yeah, pretty much. You would just get a generic ending.
What kind of like beyond that first game, what sort of determined what characters were together? Was it just like story bonds or fighting styles or there family connections?
There's always an Ikari team where they had Ralph Clark and a third character. Like it started off with Hydern, which is some generic army commander, and then Leona in the later ones. Mm. There was the Fatal Fury team where they kept together Terry, Andy, and Joe Higashi. Mm-hmm. 98, I think, introduced a female team where they had Mai, King, and Yuri, probably. There was an Art of Fighting team where they typically had Ryo, Robert, and Yuri.
Wasn't also one of them, like, as the series progressed, like, one of them was, like, the mature ladies team, and it was, like, all the characters that had been allowed to age a little bit, all the women?
There are two characters named Vice and Mature.
But I think it was, like, it was some of them, and then King, and because King has been allowed to, like, kind of, like, gracefully intermittle, like, she still, like, can, you know. But she's like the one who wears like a suit, you know, and right. She's like supposed to be
like a best. Yeah.
So by
yeah.
old, you mean they're 28?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. That's what I mean.
I thought so.
Yeah. Actually, you know, we keep kind of dinging on Mai because of the sort of overly elaborate fan service that they've given her. But for the most part, I feel like the series has done a really commendable job of bringing in female characters and making them diverse, making them interesting and unique, and not necessarily playing them up for sex appeal. Like King starts out and, you know, she's very androgynous, short hair, wears like slacks and a dress white shirt and a vest over top of it. And initially is kind of presented as a male character. And then surprise, it's a Samus twist. She's a girl.
Yeah. That's from back in Art of Fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Because it looked like a male character, and then it was either the first or the second game where, like, if you did a certain move and beat them, then their clothes would kind of fly off.
Oh,
and
so not her, exactly the most.
Yeah, her origin isn't exactly the best. They're like, a bra, oh my God.
But Jeremy, I think your point is well taken. Like, Mai really is, even now, where they've got, you know, they have much more, they can do much more with, like, the resolution and stuff. Now they've moved full 3D, of course, but. But Mai is the exception. Like most of the women characters are really not. But then again, Mai kind of takes up all the room for that. Even from the first appearance, right? She's literally hunched over with her cleavage, like facing directly to the player at all, like at her neutral stance. and they're just, it's just like a pendulum. And,
yeah, but then you have, you know, characters like Yuri, who's like a very young, very athletic looking, probably like a teenager.
Yeah.
But she's just wearing like a short sleeve gi and, you know, sweatbands, and there's no real sex appeal to her. And then you have Athena, who, you know, she's got the schoolgirl thing sometimes, but then sometimes she's got like the very like flowery pop idol thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Occasionally in some of the, I guess the spinoffs, she's been like in her original, you know, Psycho Soldier Athena.
They brought in SNK versus Capcom. She's in her bikini armor from the original Athena game. But other than that, she's pretty modestly clothed. Yeah. Even then, there's a Kasumi. She's, I don't know exactly what she is, some sort of karate master uniform.
There's a lot of those.
Yeah, I know. But this is very specific.
Right. Type. And then there's Whip, who wears a very starchy military uniform.
Yeah.
And she's paired with the Akari characters, right? Or she's the Metal Slug characters?
She isn't from that game, but I think
she's paired with
them. She's paired with them, yeah. There's Hinako, who's supposed to be a sumo wrestler, even though she's like a 18-year-old girl.
Does she actually look like a sumo wrestler?
Oh,
or
no.
Is she like skinny?
She's pretty skinny. Mm.
But she has all the powers of a sumo wrestler.
Sure, why not?
And then there's as we said, like there's Mature, who is like, she's like a reformed bad guy, or
I can't. She was paired with Yuri. They're like part of the villain team, and they were killed in '97, which is why they only make sporadic appearances. Because the structure of the King of Fighters game is that '94 doesn't really have much of a story. '95, '96, and '97 are part of the Orochi arc. '98 is a dream match where they take in most of the characters from the previous game, regardless about whether they're dead or not. '99, 2000, 2001. That does another character arc with...
Isn't that the Nests saga?
The Nests saga with K-Dash and Kula and clones of...
Yeah, see, that's where the story starts to get like... Hmm. Like I said before the episode started, you know, sometimes you look at Street Fighter and you're like, this story is pretty goofy. But then you look at King of Fighters and you're like, man, Capcom, they're babies. They have no idea. They don't even know what they're doing.
And that's another instance where I think King of Fighters, like their women characters have a chance, because there is some characterization as the... That they have, like, it's not just like this character is in love with that character. It's like, this is so and so's daughter.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so and so is like, they're related, or they have, like, you know, they, I don't know, I'm just making this up, but like, they own a restaurant together, and, you know, it's like, or whatever. Like, there's a background there that gives them a level of, it gives all the characters, frankly, like a level of, like, of humanity that's kind of weird, considering that. And it helps you distinguish them, because, to be honest, like, as much as I love the series, like, there's, to me, it still looks like there's Jacket Guy, there's the three, like, karate gi guys, there's, you know, it's because you don't have that fanciful Street Fighter style where there's, like, by now, like, what do we have? Like, there's, like, the robot mask trench coat guy, there's the...
There's, you know, like, the whole Urien thing where he's, like...
Thong guy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't even know what he's about. And then, like, Charlie came back from the dead as, like, a Frankenstein character. So, like, a zombie or something. So, yeah, they've pretty much gone off the rails with that one. But the King of Fighters storyline gets weird in more, like, of a, like, a grounded sci-fi sort of way, if that makes sense, where they're, like... You know, the big storyline with the Nests was that they were trying to clone Kyo. I don't know why Kyo is so special, but they made like 1,000 clones of him. And then there's K-Prime and Chrysalid and Zero. And like all these characters are based on Kyo. And it's like all this cloning saga. It's like they said, you know, that Spider-Man thing with the clones, that was really, really good. We should do that too.
Or like
they
the
were wrong.
Biggest criticism of fighting game expansion characters is that they're just like the other ones. Let's just like dig our fingers right into that.
Mortal Kombat things they can do clones. Just you wait, guys.
Yeah.
Was also doing that at the same time, Alpha, with like Cammy and all those.
Yeah.
They brought into some sort of M. But Bison just, psycho.
Yeah, they're all clones of M. Bison. There's like the 12 girls named for the months of the year, and all of them are like female clone host bodies for M. Bison.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, whatever.
King of Fighters is the only fighting game series where I feel like I actually have an idea of what the story is, even though my idea is more about how these characters relate to each other. But that's more interesting than it always has been than Mortal Kombat or Street Fighter.
But that's actually something that I think makes the series commendable, is that the story can work on multiple levels. You can care about the sort of like ongoing minor soap opera between the recurring characters, or you can be like into the overall saga and try to like, you know the canon. Or you can just, you know, play it as a fighting game and mix and match your teams.
Yeah.
So do we want to like give like a Kurt, like what do you think is the ultimate king, the king of fighters?
My favorite is 11, because around 2003 was they started patterning itself more after the Marvel versus games, and it's just a much faster paced game, and they allowed tag teaming, which, I mean, my attention span is pretty low when it comes to fighting games. So if I'm just like getting bored of a character, I could just switch out immediately and have another one instead of having to lose. And that one was a little bit like every time they make a new mechanic, it's a little bit unrefined. But 11, they really like is the best version of that. And also because they brought in the Garo, Mark the Wolves characters, and they also brought in other characters from really obscure SNK games. Mm-hmm. Like two of the characters actually come from the Kazuna Encounter.
Right, which is mostly known because it's so expensive for the European version.
Yeah, they made like 10 copies. And
yeah, so it's like an infamous game. But
and that was a sequel to a game called Savage Rain. And Savage Rain wasn't particularly good. But Kazuna Encounter, it had a lot of weapon-based fighting and also had a tag-based system. So they brought in the boomerang guy from that game, Hayate. And there's a guy in like a crow mask named Jazu.
So they had to integrate these weapon-based characters with more of a melee traditional fighting game.
Yeah, they had sort of done that before with Whip, because she has
that's true, yeah,
a whip. I can't remember if many of the other characters had weapons.
In SVC Chaos, they bring in quite a few Samurai Showdown characters, and they're just like slashing away. And
that's SNK versus Capcom.
Then
Neo Geo Battle Coliseum brings in like Hawamuro from Samurai Showdown.
I am a fraud.
That's okay. Those three games all kind of run together in my mind, and all of them are like super wacky takes on, increasingly wacky takes actually on the concept. I mean, once you get Zero from Mega Man in there, it's just like, okay, whatever.
I'm sure we'll have an article about this, but how are these available now? I know there's a few on the Switch, but again, there's so many of them. I'm not sure which ones are.
A lot of them are available not only on Switch, but also on PS4. Mm. The Arcade Classic Archives is like, it started on PS4, I think, and then or maybe PS3, and then is expanded to Switch.
But didn't the Wii Virtual Console have a ton of these too?
Yes, they did. You can get a bunch of them on Wii Virtual Console.
Every time they do it, they do that annoying thing where they start with King of Fighters 94, which, I mean, that didn't even get a port when it came out. Nobody likes that game. But there are two types of, well, there's all kinds of different Neo Geo ports based off of who actually made them. Mm. So you have the Arcade Classics Archives, which are done by Hamster, pretty sure. I've never actually bought any of them, but those are supposed to be pretty good.
Yeah, they're good. I don't know about Bob, but I picked up a bunch of them to kind of study for this episode.
They have,
and that was how I reminded myself that, oh yeah, I'm no good at these.
They have so many weird games on the PS4. But then you have the ones done by Code Mystics, which I think they did Metal Slug 3, Last Blade, Garo Mark of the Wolves, Samurai Shodown Special 5, I think is one they did. Then you have the ones that are the PS2 classics, because they released almost all of these on PS2 compilation discs. Mm.
And they released those were the ones that came out as like the Nest Saga, the Orochi Saga. Like they came out specifically designated as like, here's the trilogy of these fighting games.
Yeah, and what's really weird is there was, even in the context of the PlayStation 2, there were two different releases in territories, because the one in Japan is different from the one they released in America. Because I don't know who developed the Japanese versions of them, but the American ones were done by this company in Texas. They were, I think, Terminal Reality, which is, I want to say, the company that also made Blood Rain. But they were doing emulation work at that time. Mm-hmm. So they had also done the Metal Slug Anthology. And generally, those games, the emulation was not as good as the stuff that whatever comes coming out of the Japanese side. Like, they tended to, the Japanese ones, put in a little bit more effort as to integrating arranged soundtracks.
Right.
Which is another really big draw of the King of Fighters series. Mm. Whereas the other ones were just, here's a ROM of the game, it's working. But the PS4, they're basically the PS2 games. And I feel the emulation of those is a little bit weird because it's a PS4 emulating a PS2, which is emulating a Neo Geo game running on an HDTV that already has, like, it just adds to the lag. And that depends on the quality of the emulation to begin with. Like, I know the Metal Slug Anthology, at least the first one on there, just has a lot of lag in that particular version that's almost unplayable. And they have different display options, too. Like, I was playing the ADK Spirits on the PS4 yesterday, and some of them had display options that give you like the really crisp look, and some of them had 240p support, but these ones don't. Again, certain ones do, certain ones don't. ADK Spirits doesn't, and just looks really muddy compared to the ones that like Code Mystics did, where they, you know, put a lot of effort into making it look good.
Yeah, the ACA games are a little weird because you can't, as far as I can tell, you can't get like crisp integer pixel scaling, but you can put scan lines on it. So when you add the scan lines, then it's soft, but it has scan lines. So it does kind of look like, you know, what you would actually see on an arcade monitor. But it is a little like, where's the you know, like the true pixel scaling resolution?
Yeah, that's why I love what the M2 the stuff, where you could choose if you want to do, you know, one by one, or you try to put it in the correct 4x3 proportions, you want to add scan lines. Like, they just went crazy about the sort of things that they enable offered.
Well, the ACA lets you do, like, you can change the size proportionally, like 100% all the way up to like 200%, one step at a time.
Yeah.
But you still can't, you know, if you do it like 100%, you're still not getting like hard pixel edges. So it has that soft filtered look, which some people like, I'm not a big fan of. But, you know, like, it's a pretty minor issue. Otherwise, the options are pretty good. You can get, like, you can play the American version, the Japanese version. There's a caravan mode for, like, competition.
Oh, wow.
They have a ton of options. So just because I'm griping about the graphics, like, that's kind of stupid. Like, they're really well made. And, like, if you are wanting to play these games, they're a little spendy at $8 a piece. But if there is a specific game that you really like, then this is it's a really good way to play them.
Is there like one game from like the classic Neo Geo part of the series that you would recommend above the others?
98 is the one that everybody always points to as a favorite because that's one of the dream matches. But then again, both King of Fighters 98 and 2002 were remade later as Unlimited Match and Ultimate Match.
And those are pretty well regarded too, right?
Yeah, everybody loves those because that's the one where they bring in like all of the characters pretty much.
Is Heavy D back?
Heavy D, yes. Yeah. Well, Heavy D was already in King of Fighters 98.
Oh, yeah, that's
I can't remember. They probably
They had a character in King of Fighters 94 that was based off of Heavy D, the rapper.
The rapper, I was going to make a joke, but it turns out to be true.
Yes, that's exactly. I think his name was... what's his actual name? It's not really Heavy D.
I don't know, but it has an exclamation point in his name.
Yes, so. It does. That's the important part.
Okay, yeah, so here's King of Fighters 98. Okay. It's got high score mode, Japanese mode, English mode, caravan mode, and you can do various options.
That comes recommended.
I cannot connect to the internet in this hotel. But yeah, there's they did a good job with these ports for PS4 and Switch.
You can actually get King of Fighters 98 in 2002 on Steam also.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and the Steam one doesn't have quite as many features as the PS2 version of 98, but it's still pretty good. I mean, you're missing, like, maybe the arranged music, and I can't remember if it has it, and some of the 3D backgrounds that they decide to put in, but that's no big loss.
Yeah. And King of Fighters 13, I think, is...
13 is on
there. The last one that's going to have sprite art, because it's not quite like Arc System Works resolution, right? Or
I don't know what resolution it is. Like, they're kind of working on, like, 240p old arcade monitor, and then... there may be like 480p-ish, like SVGA resolution.
It's not quite Blaze Blue or Blast Blue. How are you supposed to say that? Is it Blaz Blue?
I don't know.
I think you don't pronounce the Z. That's what I've heard.
Blaze Blue.
Somebody was petting about that on a podcast, so that's why I remember.
Ah, the pronunciation police.
Yes.
See, I forget those things immediately on purpose.
Yeah, so
yeah, Brave Brew
in Japanese.
What?
Blay Blue, yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay.
Okay.
Look, it's
Ball Blazer.
Yeah.
So we should wrap this up. It's getting a little long for a micro episode, but any final thoughts on King of Fighters? It's like the series fascinates me, but I am incapable of playing it effectively. So it's kind of one of those like things that is a little out of reach, and I grasp for it and it pulls itself away from my delicate fingers.
You don't need to play it competitively. I've never even just the sort no, of
I can't
game
even play I can't even I can play competently single player.
But it's just something to get into the lore of, and the music was another thing that actually eased me into the series, because each of the teams has different like themes to it. Like Kyo's is always called Esaka, like the train station. It's always a hard rock theme. Iori's is always saxophone based. There's usually a hard rock theme for the Korean guys. So they sort of keep that consistent through most of them, except for the games with the bad soundtracks, like 2001.
You mentioned a competitive scene. Are these games played in the high level like video game fighting tournaments? I don't remember seeing them really.
I don't think so. I don't know if it's anything they take seriously. Like King of Fighters 14, they came out last year, and I don't know if that was in Evo. I don't really follow the scene.
I haven't heard. My impression of 14 is that it's gotten kind of a lukewarm reception, but that might just be because it's no longer sprite art.
Yeah,
it's ugly as hell, but they have so many new characters in that game because with when they had to redraw everybody, they had like a tiny roster.
Yeah.
And the fact that they look kind of crappy makes up for the fact that there's so many of them. Although just this week, I think there's a CG anime that just started, King of Fighters Legacy, and apparently that is real bad looking.
Every CG anime is bad looking.
But this one is like worse character models than even King of Fighters 14.
I have to see if it's worse than Berserk, because that's pretty bad.
Yeah. I think it's okay to appreciate King of Fighters on a purely aesthetic level. I think that is especially the classic games, because you're seeing how much they could do with very, very little. And that's always the appeal of like Neo Geo games. And although it didn't get as like, it's not like Garou or something like that. You know, they were going for something, and it didn't strike the same chord here in North America, but you can kind of appreciate it as this kind of beautiful little artifact. And it was an annualized fighting game series. Like, how often does that happen?
And they change more than like between Street Fighter Alpha and Street Fighter Alpha 2, they add new backgrounds and stuff. But they really shook up things a little bit more with each entry, because they were always like slightly changing the mechanics, swapping in and out characters. They, especially around 99, they sort of took a different style to them, both with the character designs and just the general atmosphere. It's kind of like a little edgier and more modern, right. More electronic.
Well, I mean, King of Fighters is on 14. Street Fighter is on 5.
Yeah. Well, that's so, not counting all the alphas
and zeros
EXs.
Yeah. But still.
Yeah.
Though, I mean, those were all kind of dead ends in a sense.
No, they're all canon, every last one of them.
Somehow. And Bob, any final thoughts for yourself? You've been very quiet.
I just episode. Feel like a total fraud, and I was cramming for this subject, but it is hard to get into if you're really new to it, because again, I confuse all of these SNK fighting games, and I know there's good stuff to them, but it just like just this volume of stuff hitting you, and I feel like I need to dip into maybe like 98 to see what I miss, because again, like by the time I could access these games regularly, I had stopped playing fighting games because I sucked at them. So I was just like, well, that's not for me, and I'll just forget about it. But now I'm learning that there's like a lot to these things. So
yeah, I mean, I followed this series somewhat closely in the late 90s, just because I was like, no, damn it, I'm gonna keep 2D games alive in my heart. So that was one of the few series that was kind of like, you know, big and still in 2D with sprites, but I just like I never could get into it, and going back to it now, I'm like, man, there's so much to this series. Like this whole Nests things and the whole Ash Crimson thing. We didn't even mention him. It's just like
it's okay.
There's so much.
They forgot
so much.
Him in 14 anyway. So. But the first game I actually played in the series was 98, called 99 in the Dreamcast, and I was just it's very overwhelming. You get this character selection screen with like 40 different people. Who are all of these people?
Yeah.
Why do I have to select three of them? How do any of these play? Like I was only got into it because one of my friends in college was huge into SNK stuff, Chris Raza, who writes for Hardcore Gaming 101 every once in a while. And he sort of helped introduce me to the lore of all this. Like, it's easier to be like, oh, that guy did this. This one is a lost character from something other, blah, blah, blah.
It's wild nights at college.
Yeah.
Wild college years.
Yeah, I mean, I still play occasionally Marvel vs. Capcom, you know, just for fun. And I can recognize at least 80% of those characters on the screen, even though there's 100 little squares. It's like, oh, I know who that guy is and who that guy is. And that guy's probably from a comic I never read. So, but with Art of Fighting, I'm just like, who, where's the baseball hat guy? Where's the, oh, wait, that's, never mind. Samurai Shodown.
Yeah.
Rival Schools has a baseball hat guy.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I guess to sum it up, like if you see one of these, you'll see a character selection screen that's massive, and that's kind of feels like the game's telling you go away, you know, but it's not, you know, just try it out. And nobody's really that good at any of them anymore because it's not, you know, it's like, just give it a shot.
All right. Thanks guys for walking us through the King of Fighters series, because we couldn't have done this on our own. By God.
That's clear.
So we'll wrap this episode up. Thanks everyone for listening.
Hello, it's me, Bob Mackey. I don't know a lot about fighting games, but I do know a lot about The Simpsons, and you can listen to my other podcast, Talking Simpsons, every Wednesday at TalkingSimpsons.com. We have a Patreon, too, with all kinds of extra stuff, but you can find that on your own. But if you like The Simpsons, give the show a shot, and I will say you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo.
Guests, pimp the hell out of yourself. Yeah. Go for it. You carried this. You deserve the plaudits.
Give them your money, everybody.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, well, I'm at HG_101 on Twitter. We're also on Patreon at patreon.com/HG101. And we're running a crowdfunding campaign through a British publisher called Unbound to create a big book of Japanese video game obscurities, which I think the only SNK game I have scheduled in there is that Days of Memory dating series. But the idea is just to feature lots of pictures and lots of really weird Japanese games. I'm trying to figure out as much that hasn't had anything written in English yet. So
like, I love the concept. I love
even
it.
If you're a big nerd, there's a lot
you
of
got
stuff.
You got Lolita syndrome in there, right?
There's a couple of games I'm like, this is kind of historically important, but they're creepy as hell. Yeah. So kind of don't want to put that in there.
But if you can read about them, you don't have to play them.
Yeah.
You will not be on a list.
Although there is the game that started Dead of the Brain. There's this game that a middle schooler had bought in Kyoto, I think, and somebody found out about it and actually caused the government to examine the Japanese pornographic game industry and found that it was not up to code.
Mm.
So the guy went to jail and they had to start making other games.
Wow. All right. So look forward to that.
Yeah.
Support that on Kickstarter, please.
Oh, Unbound.
Oh, Unbound.
Yeah. Yeah. They actually take care of all the design and editing, so I can,
you can find there's a link at the top of the of hardcoregaming101.net.
Yeah. It's my pinned tweet at the moment.
There's also a link to the Hardcore Gaming 101 podcast, which is, if you like Retronauts and you want less depth and, no, I mean, we rank the games and we go through them pretty fast. We just finished recording an episode that covered, the one that's up right now, I don't know what will be up there, but there is a huge argument on our latest episode, 62, about Super RC Pro-Am for Game Boy. If you want to know what it's like to argue about or hear an argument about Super RC Pro-Am for Game Boy that goes on for, I think, over half an hour.
Wow. Just an argument.
And it's three people versus me. I'm just trying to like explain how, like, you know, if you think about it, this does a good job and like kids loved it and it sold like a million copies. Don't put it all the way down. Where did they want to put it? Like by like X-Men for NES or something like that. Towards the bottom of the list. Like,
come on.
Or something like that. It was down there. And I was like, just, you know, so that's the kind of thing we do.
That sounds like time well spent, honestly.
Yeah, well, and then the second game we did was the original Far Cry, which is another interesting game to talk about. And we just have to do what people nominate. So that's how it works. And who knows what we'll do next.
week in Retronauts, home games, and don't spare the horses. Everyone, and welcome to you okay there,
Just freaked me out there for a second.
Did I?
Yeah. Was that a, like a reference to a 50s Western show?
I don't know what it's from. Home it's, James and Don't Spare the Horses.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I forget.
But anyway, it was just a random reference. For this exciting episode of Retronauts Micro, hi, I'm Jeremy Parrish, and this is a continuation of our last Retronauts East episode, co-starring
Ben Edwards
and
Ben Elgin.
And last time we talked about the experience of playing arcade games during the 80s and 90s. And now we're looking at the flip side of that and talking just kind of about, you know, the process of being a home game person, playing video games at home. And
that's too broad a topic.
It is broad. It is broad. It's probably going to narrow down. Yes. But we'll be just, I don't know. Again, it's a loosely organized discussion, chaos. And we're going to cut it short at about 45 minutes because it's a micro episode and those are supposed to be 10. So
this is the new micro.
They've expanded now that we've gone full time.
So
we've talked about the arcades and what it was like playing video games in arcades, playing tokens and quarters and Chuck E. Cheese's and singing bears and all that kind of crap. And now, you know, we're talking about the flip side of that. What was it like to be a kid in the 80s and 90s who wanted to play video games at home? And you had consoles and computers and you had different experiences than now. But when playing video games now has its own culture around it. It's all pretty much internet-based. There's a lot of YouTube. There's a lot of game facts. There's a lot of social media and forums. It's just, it's a different, like you approach video games differently as a result of not only the way the games are designed, but also the resources that are available to you. Those were not there. There was no YouTube in 1987.
No,
there
was internets.
Nope. There was a primitive internet, but it was not used for sharing video game facts. And you definitely were not watching live streams of British people playing Minecraft.
I was in ASCII.
Damn. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You logged on to the Whole Earth Electric Link and were like, all right, San Francisco hippies, tell me about the latest patch to Minecraft.
I did have some video game ASCII art from BBS's in the early 90s, but yeah, not game facts. We have lots of things, but what should we start with?
We're still suffering from Burger King poisoning.
Yeah, that's only you. That's because you made the bad choice of eating at Burger King. I did not. So let's talk, because Ben brought his missed journal.
I did.
And I have my missed journal that I dug up recently. Ben did not bring his missed journal. Yeah,
you blew it, dude. Things. I got other props and stuff. Paper and
that's not helping. You messed up, man.
It's okay. I played it on the Atari Jaguar, like I told you. CD.
Sorry. I'm so sorry.
Why are you sorry?
I don't know. It just seems like a bad way to play it.
It's a great way to play it.
Like, probably not as bad as playing it on PSP, but still.
It's actually a good port. It was a competent port. But that's just the only way.
Did you have mouse controls for it? Or was it joystick?
No.
D-pad.
I used a D-pad. But it was rendered well, and it was neat. I mean, set of Jaguar CD games from Tiger Direct, and it happened to be in that set, you know, 96 when they're on clearance, and I played it. It was fun.
But anyway, no game journal. Facts. So you're solving the puzzles by your lonesome, making your maps by your lonesome, basically.
Yeah. Video game manuals used to have these pages at the back that just had lined, like notes. Ruled lines that said notes or things along those lines. And you were actually supposed to use those to write things down and use them for later.
Yeah, and on Nintendo games, it might just be like your passwords that you were saving for continues or whatever. But also, yeah, yeah, stuff for puzzles, stuff for things you learned about the game, you know, find out what weapon works on one what boss, write it down so you remember later, because you're not going to just be able to look it up. So,
and if you're like me, you didn't write it, and now your manuals are worth a lot more money.
I don't know. I actually really like it when I buy a game that has to stuff, yeah. photograph and scan, and I open it up, and it has like life in it. You know, yeah. It's like the Velveteen mm-hmm. Rabbit. The love makes it real.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a like I know some people are really particular about getting perfect mint box mm-hmm. copies of games, and I guess I should be because I'm photographing them and publishing them, but. I feel like, I don't know, like the games that have some wear to them have a story to them. Like these are games that people actually played, and hopefully they're kind of worn because the people liked these games. They wrote their names on the back of the cartridge in mm-hmm. marker, and mm-hmm. they thumbed through the manual, and it's got water damage on it. And it's not
Coke,
because they're
Coke
careless.
Damage.
Yeah, well,
Coke was water back then, by the way. It came in through the taps.
Yes, that's right. Benji lived someplace with brown water. He thinks it's Coke, but
I drank more Coke, you know, than anything. When between the age of like 4 and 18, I must have drank thousands and thousands of gallons of Coke.
Yeah, I didn't understand that water was important to drink.
Yeah.
It was good for you back then.
Grew up from that. But yeah,
it was real sugar, not corn syrup.
I like the perspective of the history of an object, of how it was used and the wear. Like Jeremy's saying, I appreciate that also in computers too that have been modified. I like to keep those modifications because it's part of the history of how it was actually used. And that's very valuable to historians in all fields, not just this.
Yeah. And I think during this era, a lot more games were kind of designed with that expectation in mind that people were going to be taking their own notes and working stuff out, that because, you know, we didn't have instant access to all the answers, that more things were designed with the expectation that you were going to maybe draw your own map, or you were going to write down these clues that someone gave you in the game and then, you know, have this on hand to use later, as opposed to just the game keeping track of it all for you. Because, you know, nowadays, if the game doesn't keep track of it, well, you can just look it up anyways. So what difference does it even make? And there's niche things now that still do this because people think it's fun. So you've got your Etrian Odysseys that are geared towards making maps because that's fun for
people. There's this guy who does these videos where he makes maps.
And now Jeremy's doing it with Metroid, right?
Oh,
It's you know, it was something that I really did sort of out of necessity when I was playing NES games. Mm-hmm. The Goonies 2 and Metroid and a few others. Like, I didn't really know how to navigate video game spaces at that point. So I would use the actual. I would use graph paper to make maps as I went along, and you know, I wasn't super meticulous about it, but I tried to kind of keep it to one screen per graph paper square or whatever. And I would take notes on where, you know, you needed to find secret passages, or where you could find items, and where the doors were, where the hidden spots were, and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And it was not something that someone taught me how to do. It was just something that I intuited naturally. And a lot of people did. Like, if you look back, like, lots and lots of people played games making map paper, making maps on graph paper.
Some games you can't play without making a map. I mean, you just get hopelessly lost. So that was a big part of not just console games, but a lot of computer RPGs mm-hmm. like The Bard's Tale and Might and Magic.
Well, and back with like text adventures, when you had no graphics to look at all, mm-hmm. often like drawing something out
Zork.
Was the only way you'd have any idea where you were or what was going on. So stuff like Zork.
Yeah, when I started doing these maps again and tweeting about it, someone tweeted back at me that they had just picked up a copy of Wizardry for NES. Mm-hmm. And it seems like some older lady had played the game, like a grandmotherly type, mm-hmm. and had taken these beautiful, meticulous notes, and her handwriting was so good. And she made not just like graph paper maps, but like extensive notes written out in this, you know, just like this elegant, almost calligraphy, like this elegant hand.
Awesome.
That just like I would love to see those up close. Like, those are real video gaming archival treasures, like these things that mm-hmm. are not part of the games themselves, but they are so connected and so integral to the experience of the game. And to watch the way people like interpret these games and you know, put them down into writing is really fascinating to me.
Yeah, they taught handwriting very well back then, previous generation. You know, they don't even teach cursive in the schools around here anymore. So
I didn't know that. That's not really kind of where I was going with that,
though. Yeah, that's a tangent.
But it is.
I think it's cool that, I mean, that's just another thing that people won't have the experience of, the requirement of using paper and the craft of the paper and the ink. That's just sort of a lost art. That's my point, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, I stopped making maps because I got better at navigating, you know, virtual spaces in my mind and keeping track of where I'd been. But then after
cyborg implant,
yes, it was very helpful. Once I uploaded my brain to the internet, then the need for mapping actually disappeared because games started creating maps automatically for you. Yeah. I don't remember what the first game I played with an auto map was. I mean, The Legend of Zelda had it, but...
Didn't you say Goonies 2 had a map built in?
It did, but that was not a useful map. I mean, it showed you where you were in the world, but it didn't give you any details on, like, how the spaces interconnected and where you... how you could go from one space to another.
I'm trying to think, like,
where the items were.
Super Metroid.
Yeah, Super Metroid one, obviously. Yeah. I was trying to think if there was anything earlier.
That was a groundbreaking map.
Yeah, it sort of became the standard.
Yeah, it was very detailed. It showed you, the area you were in. It showed you where the hidden passages were. It would kind of like automatically create boundaries for the spaces you were in. So if there was, you know, a broken line, you knew, oh, there's more over here. I need to go back there. Mm-hmm. It also would give you like this little sort of grayed out dot where there was a hidden object on that screen and you hadn't found it yet.
Yep.
So you knew to go back there and look for it. Yeah. Energy tank or missile or whatever.
Yeah. It really became the gold standard. Mm-hmm. But, and then the one thing, like the thing that tangentially related to this is I really wish everything on 3DS would let you write on your maps. Like a few games do. Some of the Zeldas do.
Yeah, Zelda, Etrian Odyssey.
And it's like such a useful thing. And it also, of course, you know, tickles the nostalgia from when we were all doing this on paper.
Yeah.
And like, I'd like, why does everything on 3DS not do this?
But it's been surprising to me though, as I've been starting to do these game maps and I'll, you know, tweet about my progress. It really resonates with people. Like people are way more into this than I expected. Yeah. I thought most, you know, people would be like, what the hell are you doing, weirdo? But every time I tweet out a map, it gets hundreds and hundreds of likes and retweets and shares. I'm like, wow, this is like something that clearly connects with people in some respect.
Well, it was a universal experience for a certain generation of gamers, and you're tapping into something that hasn't been mostly forgotten. So, and it resonates, like you said.
It's gratifying to see. Like, I'm really happy that people are like, oh yeah, I did that too. That's awesome.
It's like a way to connect with the game, even when you're not actually playing it, which sort of segues into the other thing that we did have. You know, we couldn't look up maps on the internet, but we had magazines, which often had maps of stuff. A lot of time, you know, just the first few levels to give you a taste of stuff. But so like Nintendo Power would print maps of all kinds of things. And then sometimes you'd get the strategy guide, which had tons of maps.
Yeah. Before we segue all the way out, I will say, though, like kind of building on something you just said, that creating these maps just for the couple of games I've done them for, Metal Gear for MSX and Metroid, doing like these really extensive in-depth maps has really helped me appreciate how these games are constructed, how these virtual worlds are put together.
Yeah.
Like even doing, you know, Anatomy of Games write-ups, I never really kind of stopped and took a holistic view of the world and how all the pieces fit together.
The physical space, not only that,
but also like the kind of flow and how you're supposed to go to one place and then backtrack and retrace your steps and how things are designed to kind of push you and guide you.
You can get this overview of the game design through the maps. Yeah. Which was one of the things I think that's one of the reasons I kept subscribing to Nintendo Power forever. It's just even for games I never played, looking at these maps and like getting this design sense of how these games were put together was just so great.
Well, and when you create a hand-drawn map and it's really kind of more reductive, and, you know, I've been putting, like, the interactive spaces in a stage. Like in Metroid, like, drawing the platforms and where the walls are. But you don't put the background details in. You don't see colors. Sure. You don't see things like that. When you break it down like this, you start to see that, like, each area of the game has kind of its own personality. Like, some spaces are very sort of wide open and expansive. Some spaces are very dense. there are like these motifs that repeat throughout. It's been really interesting to kind of get inside the creators' heads this way.
You know, some of those in Nintendo Power were collections of screenshots. Remember, mm-hmm. screens mm-hmm. as arranged in a map. But some of them, a lot of them were illustrated mm-hmm. specifically for the magazine. And it might be interesting to talk to some of those people who did those illustrations back in the day.
Yeah, you know, I would love to do that. But my understanding is that early Nintendo Powers were actually mostly created in Japan by, I don't remember the publisher, if it was Shokakukan or Shueisha. I don't remember who it was, but... yeah, my understanding is that all that stuff was created like by an agency in Japan. Huh. So finding those people would probably be impossible.
Yeah, for
which is disappointing, Americans. But yeah. I mean, even over there, like it would probably be
some
really
intern
difficult.
Working on salary was drawing these things.
Out. Yeah, exactly. Like it was there may not be any record of like who actually did this work.
Well, if anyone listening knows, let us know.
That would be awesome, but but yeah, someone else suggested that to me, and I was like, it's impossible. I think Simon Parkin said something to me about that, and I was like, as much as I would, that would be like a dream article. Like, I don't even know where to begin looking for people who worked for a design publishing agency
contractor
in Japan
for
1986. Yeah. That's tough.
Yeah,
it is tough.
But it's even if we don't know who actually created those maps. The fact that their work is out there and people still kind of hold these fond memories of it.
The artistry is left behind.
They've left a legacy.
Yeah.
Saying before I pushed back to where we had been.
Yes. What?
You were saying?
I don't know.
So one of our big sources of information without having everything online was these magazines. Yeah. Uh-huh. So, you know, you had your Nintendo Power, you had your, what was early on, EGM and GamePro, when did they come in?
They came in around the same time as Nintendo Power, 1988-89.
Yeah.
Like for me, Nintendo, you know, I had Nintendos at home, so Nintendo Power was the one I had subscription to, but I would pick up random issues of other ones just off the shelf sometimes.
There's actually a really, there's a several year gap in the US where there were no publications covering console games. Mm-hmm. And up until, I think, the launch of Nintendo Power, the only publication that even cared at all about console games was called... Computer Entertainer, I think, and Frank Cifaldi.
Oh, yeah, video games and Computer Entertainer.
Not VG and CE. It was the Computer Entertainer, newsletter put together apparently by a woman somewhere in California. And this is something Frank Cifaldi told me about a couple of years ago, and I had never heard of it.
That's the one with the review of Super Mario Brothers 1. Like the only printed review of Super Mario Brothers 1 was
that was in a newspaper someplace.
Like you're trying to.
I think that was Ed Simrad.
Oh, really? Doing a freelance thing for a newspaper.
I'm pretty sure that's what you're thinking of.
Wow.
But yeah, this one publication, it was like basically zine style. It was very sort of lo-fi. Mm-hmm. But it's like the best resource for getting actual information about release dates and about, you know, publication schedules and things like that. Not only for NES, but for other platforms like Atari 7800 and whatever else was still extant at that point, 1986, 87.
Yeah. It was a lonely
place.
So
I guess I got into Nintendo about the same time as Nintendo Power was starting up. So it was with Super Mario 2. Because I know there's a Super Mario 2 cover, claymation cover for Super Mario 2, which I think I have.
That's the first issue.
Is that the first
Power.
One? Yeah.
They sent that to everyone. Yeah. Millions of copies of that issue went out. Yep.
But remember, so it was Nintendo Fun Club News first. We've talked about that before, right?
I think so.
And that turned into Nintendo Power.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
So We have nothing else to say.
No, so that was,
it seemed like Ben was going someplace with that.
Yeah, sorry.
That was kind of our source of, that was basically the source of information from on high on what was going on in the games world, what was coming up, and also like stuff like maps and stats and things of games that were out. Without having GameFAQs, without having YouTube, we sort of got this all filtered through the corporate magazines. And other than that, it was just, so it was kind of the two things. We had the corporate magazines, and then you had like Playground Rumors on the other hand, which is, you know, people who had just seen games, but yeah. It was a varying reliability depending on how cool your friends were.
The rumors were important. Remember, I think you wrote about the Minus World in the notes.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a rumor that spread really fast around my neighborhood, you know, that you could go to the secret world in Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, a lot of these things came from magazines. I think the Minus World was in Nintendo Fun Club newsletter, but not everyone had access to that.
Right, yeah, because I didn't have that.
I had a friend who subscribed to it before I did, and then I subscribed for like the last two or three issues before it became Nintendo Power.
That's what we
did. So a lot of these things, like, there would be one kid who was kind of like the early adopter and had all the cool stuff, and information would sort of trickle from him. Of course, also, some people just lied about stuff.
Yeah. Well, I have a similar story, which is that, you know, I did BBSing in the early 90s and early internet. You know, I used the internet from 93 to the present. And so, and CompuServe. And there were forums on CompuServe in the early 90s we talked about video games. And at my school, I was probably like the only kid with CompuServe. So I would download all the Mortal Kombat fatality stuff. And then I would reformat it into my own notes and pretend like I was the guy who made all this up. And then I'd hand it out to all my friends and these other kids. And they thought I was so cool.
Such a stinker.
Yeah.
Fanzines were also a thing back then. I don't know exactly when those started up, but there are a lot of people who kind of got their start in the games press by doing fanzines, like Chris Kohler.
Chris Kohler did that. I remember hearing
and,
that.
Yeah, Jess Reagan and a few other people. And, you know, they were all like 12 years old.
Yeah.
So I know they look back on their old stuff and they're like,
oh,
God, I'm such an idiot. But, you know, like they were pretty much imitating, you know, like taking their cues from the publications at the time. You had your Nintendo Power that had the very dry sort of corporate tone, and when it tried to be personable, it was like dad jokes. But then you had stuff like Game Fan and EGM, where it was like by, you know, snot-nosed punks putting together magazines, like 200-page magazines, with a staff of 5 people every month, just trying to fill out as many pages as possible to justify their, you know, their ad sales, and getting information secondhand from Japanese magazines, or like one dude would go over to Tokyo Game Show or Space World and take a bunch of photos. You know, it was just like ramshackle. And so there was this kind of amateurish air to it and a lot of attitude, like, you know, as you know, tends to be kind of like the macho element of video games. That's always been there. It's not something that's brand new.
I feel, you know what? I feel like that was invented by those magazines. That macho thing that is so looked down upon now. I think it came from EGM, and like especially EGM. GamePro was more like a kiddie thing, but EGM broadcast that, you know,
EGM and
persona. Yeah, and Game Fan
be edgy enough for an older audience.
Yeah. I feel like that was the genesis of that whole gamer identity thing.
I feel like it was probably channeling something else, but it definitely was a vector that it spread through.
Yeah, way of spreading it. But what blew my mind about EGM, I think I first started reading it in 92, and I subscribed to it till the end, and it was not afraid to criticize Nintendo games. You know, Nintendo Power was a propagandic arm of propagandistic, whatever that adjective is, you know, arm of Nintendo. And
I used to call it Nintendo Pravda.
Nintendo Pravda,
that was
a
common one,
So when I was a kid, I had no idea that that was the case. I didn't know that they were afraid to give bad reviews to their games and that they, you know, were always going to be positive about that.
This game got a 3.5 out of 5, but it's not good. What's the deal?
Yeah, what's the deal?
Get it.
Hey, guys.
Yeah.
What's going on? So that was cool. That was like discovering a whole new world. It's kind of like, you know, you have the front of something, and then you I don't have a metaphor, damn it. You go behind the shop and there's guys like, hey, kid, you go out into the back alley
and people handing out crack cocaine.
Crack, you want some crack?
But you're talking about the flip side of that is a lot of these publications, you know, not having a lot of official access to stuff that you know, you get things printed that were not really a whole lot better than Playground rumors. So you'd have stuff about, you know, things coming out next year. And, well, you know, maybe half of those things actually existed next year. Although that happened even with the official stuff. So, like, I actually just took some photos of some of Square's newsletters from the 90s. This was another thing. A lot of the publishers would put out their own newsletters to supplement what would get into the magazines. So Square had the Ogopogo Examiner with Square's newsletter for a little while. I have a few issues of that. I just put some up on my blog. But a lot of them were talking about how this game in Japan, Final Fantasy V, was going to come out as Final Fantasy III, you know, anytime now, really. Mm-hmm. And this was in Square's newsletter. Because they just, you know, they knew some things were going on internally and it might happen, and they printed it. But
yeah, a bunch of publishers had their own internal rags that they like. I think the one that I subscribed to was Sunsoft's. And that one confused me for a long time, or filled me with misunderstandings, because it talked about, like, it had an interview with the American who designed Blaster Master. So I didn't realize it was not an American game. It was made in Japan. He was actually the guy who, like, did the cutscenes for the US version, but they didn't present it that way. It was not like, here's the guy who added the new story for Blaster Master. Mm-hmm. It was like, here's the guy who made Blaster Master. So they played kind of fast and loose.
Yeah.
I didn't understand localization back then either.
Yeah.
You were, you know, 7 years old. Yeah. It's okay.
Didn't understand much. I didn't understand. I don't know. Just forget it.
I kind of want to know where this was going to go. Yeah.
Deadly Towers.
What?
Yeah, so tell me about what it was like to be a kid playing Deadly Towers.
It was great.
Fantastic. Great. Well, that was our Deadly Towers episode, everyone. Thanks for listening.
It was tricky. I mean, we had the EF and the FE code that we found in Nintendo Power that made it easier. But
what code is that?
The EF or FE code. If you die, you get your password and you put EF or FE on the front of it, and it gives you, like, all the items, you know, to give you power enough to actually go get somewhere in the game.
Now, that's something that is definitely lost in video games, is password hacking.
Yes.
Yeah. And what about the Justin Bailey code in Metroid?
Yeah, that was just apparently just a thing that's totally random.
Coincidence.
Yeah.
That happened to give you that set of save state.
Yeah, there's a few of them, like Icarus fights Medusa Angels. Like, I don't think these were actually designed to be real codes in the game, but it's just, you know, they activate certain things.
Happened to set the bits that got you that game state.
With the Game Genie, we made a code called Luigi-O that did something really cool in Super Mario Brothers. I don't remember what it was, but
yeah,
just coincidence.
I don't know that I ever really hacked passwords, but I know some people did. But what I did was I actually cracked the Mega Man 3 code.
Yes, those you could do.
Mega Man 2 came out, and Nintendo Power was like, here's how it works. And so I sat down in Mega Man 3 when that came out and was like, I bet I can figure out how this works.
Like a little Bletchley Park.
I don't know.
Enigma codes during World War II.
Yeah. Okay. Why not?
I am a computer and technology historian. What do you expect?
I understood that reference.
Okay
good.
So I sent that into Nintendo Power, and they gave the credit to someone else. Those jackasses.
Oh, man.
So like they're monsters.
So you could create any Mega Man 3 code you want.
Yeah, so it's like this spot is an energy tank.
Yeah,
and this spot is this
you could,
weapon.
You could,
and,
you know, specifically choose which bosses you wanted to have defeated. So if you're like, I don't want to fight Top Man again, you could have Top Man defeated, but you could also have, you know, four energy tanks.
Wow. Castlevania 3 had a grid-based... You put a whip in one.
The grid-based ones, like Mega Man and Castlevania, were pretty easy to do.
Huh. Yeah, because it's not that many bits in the end. It's only a little bit of information.
Well, the last thing I got to say about Deadly Towers is what I've always said about it, probably, which is the mapping. My friend mapped it, and I scanned him and put them on vintagecomputing.com back in 2005, and they were the first Deadly Tower maps on the internet. Still proud of that.
Still probably the only ones.
there have been more.
Yeah, there's VGMaps.com that does a lot of games, even if they don't really need it.
It's exciting. We got all these comments. There's probably like 100 or 200 comments on that post. They're like, oh, I didn't know anybody else loved Deadly Tower. You know, they felt so good. Anyway, we don't have to talk about it anymore. It's okay.
So what else do we have on our list? What games did you guys map? I'm curious.
I always let my brother do it because he always liked to map things and write notes about everything. And he had just stacks of graph paper. So every once in a while, I'm at my mom's house and I find an old notebook and it's full of maps and lists of monsters. And, you know, he tried to measure. There are games like Archon on the Atari 800 where he measured the shot speed of every character and, you know, nice. Tried to quantify all that stuff. And wow. Unsurprisingly, he became a programmer. So that kind of mind. Analytical
so, okay. Mind. So yeah, like how you treat video games is a prediction of what you're going to be like when you grow up.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what else. So I did have, like, I had some maps in this Myst notebook right here. I like drew out one of the islands.
Wow.
And, there was this one that was all like platforms connected with walkways. I've got one drawn out here.
The old platforms.
Along with,
So
yeah,
Myst is actually a platformer. Drew,
no.
Sure.
I drew several of the islands in here, as well as just writing out a whole bunch of the puzzles.
Yeah, I've got what appears to be like the impact site for Tokyo 3 from Evangelion.
Yes.
This is clearly an impact.
I have that one right here. Same island.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Now that I look at this, I'm like, wow, what happened on this planet? I need to go back and play Myst sometime and see, like, what world is this?
Your maps are prettier than
mine. How did I beat that without drawing any maps?
I don't know. How did you?
I guess
you were slumming it on Jaguar.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I did not make it through Myst without a little bit of cheating.
I must have looked.
I didn't have the internet at that point yet.
You can tell Jeremy is the more graphic artist between us. His maps are much nicer.
Yeah, but it's all right.
Oh, yeah. Look at these constellations. I've got the arrow and the flamingo.
I've totally got those, too. Yeah. We pretty much drew all these same things.
You know what? I think the Jaguar version may have come with a manual that had some clues in it.
Yeah, there's
that
the constellations. That may have been
what it's like, some of those things.
Wow, I haven't looked at these.
I have no idea.
Notes.
No, remember.
These mean nothing to me now, but
do you have
they're
the,
very detailed.
Do you have the keyboard drawn out, too?
I do have the keyboard.
Yeah.
This is probably boring for the listeners at home. So while they look at the maps, I'll tell you about
I'll scan this there.
Yeah, we'll
and
see.
Put
we'll
it
scan.
In the episode
notes. I can put some on my blog,
I've
too.
Got
yeah,
the keyboard.
I've got that one. But I'm trying to think what else. I did. I mean, I think I did the manhole, too, which was Shannon's earlier thing.
Yeah, that's a cool
one. And that, you know, you were just talking about people getting into programming. I mean, that led directly to me doing my own HyperCard adventure games, which I, you know, made maps for and then created the game from the maps.
Did you see the new HyperCard stuff on the Internet Archive?
What? You were telling me about that. Yeah, that they'll run HyperCard in the browser now, which is pretty awesome.
Pretty neat.
That feels like...
Good job, Jason.
I can't believe that hadn't happened before.
Yeah.
Like, HyperCard in a web browser? Yeah, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. But that's brilliant.
I mean,
there's
a lot. There's a lot of depth to it. You got to re-implement a whole scripting language. So it's not a small project. But.
Okay, here's the part in Myst where I cheated. I did not get the sound puzzle, so I was like stumped
was
there,
tricky.
And I drew it out.
Yeah,
and as far as I could get, but I was like, what the hell am I doing? And so then I went and looked at a strategy guide at the mall or whatever, and it was like, you're going to get different sounds when you go different directions. And I said, oh,
yeah.
So my notes here, north. Clink.
Clink.
E.
Yep.
Vuyush. S. Clink. West. Whir.
Whir.
Okay, my east is bzwi and my west is twiddle, but you know.
You know, I guess it's whatever, like our onomatopoeia are different.
Yep.
You've got more of like a Brazilian Portuguese style. I've got more of a Japanese.
Yeah.
Totally.
But yeah, looking back through this book, I took a lot more notes on Myst than I realized. And then I spoiled the plot at the end. Sorry about that.
Okay. Everybody's played that by now, right?
I think so.
100 times.
It's don't like give them the colored pages. That's all I got to say.
Did you want to talk about buying things? I don't remember.
Oh, yeah.
Games cost a lot of money back then.
I mean, the Toys R Us buying experience? Or is that
the Toys R Us buying experience, there's not that much to say about it. But I don't think they do games the way they used to, where starting with the NES days, started to put their games behind like the security wall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So instead of, you know, just going and saying, "Hey, I want to buy Mario," you'd have to go to a wall, and they had these plastic laminated cards with the box art on front, and underneath each, there was a like a vinyl pouch with a paper ticket inside that had the price on it and the name of the game, and it represented the number of stock they had of that game. So you would take that and take it to checkout, and then after you paid for it, you could take it to the security.
They go security to pick up.
Security.
Yeah, this depends on where you live.
Yeah, not where we live, but
security to pick up.
Yep.
So the bottom of that flap had the back of the box art too.
Did you ever lift up the flap? Yeah, it was really awkward when you were like, you know, four feet tall, and there were things on the top rack. You're like, what's up in that game?
That's how, you know, not only Nintendo Power, but there are a lot of games that didn't get any coverage, and you just saw them for the first time at a store, and you could sit there and study the box art and say, what is this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I used to go and obsess over those. I would, like, look at every one that I could and be like, what is this game? Some of them I could tell right away, this doesn't seem good, but some of them were kind of tempting. Like, Athena had really cool box art. And the back of the box, the platform action seemed like maybe it was okay. And I almost bought that the summer that I was hunting all over the country for Castlevania. And I'm really, really glad that I held out for Castlevania.
Instead of?
Yeah.
Athena.
Athena, yeah.
Can you imagine? I wouldn't be doing this job now.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that. I got the X-Men Nintendo game one year for my birthday, and it was so bad we took it back, and I got Bionic Commando instead.
Nice.
It's a good trade.
Major upgrade, yeah.
It was cheaper, too, but I was like, Mom, can I get an extra game because it's like half the price? And she said, nope.
Oh.
But, you know, harsh. I had fun with the X-Men just a little bit, but, you know, it was hard.
Throwing it off a building, setting fire to it.
Running it over with your car. Mm. The other thing about...
You're driving young.
Toys R Us, Well, I had a Power Wheels,
Power makes it go.
The other thing about Toys R Us that was so neat was their glass wall cases of actual physical examples of the game consoles and accessories that you could see under white, you know, brilliant white light.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember looking at the Atari 2600 Junior, the XE, the 7800, the NES, the Sega Master System, and in that era. And also then when the Genesis came out, I was like, whoa, what is that? And TurboGrafx. And then they also had this area off to the left in the store where I was that had a big display of Game & Watch. Portable games, the dual screen ones that would flip up, like Zelda and Donkey Kong.
I always associate those with older electronic stores. I don't remember seeing a lot of those once, you know, like the NES came out.
That was early. Yeah, it was really early on.
Yeah.
It was probably around the time NES first came out.
Now, I bought some stuff at Toys R Us, but actually more commonly in the like early 90s, I think, maybe late 80s, early 90s, I would go to the mall and go to Babbage's. That was my spot.
Check this out.
You've got the Babbage's bag right there.
I've got Babbage's, Softrex, etc.
This was before everything merged into itself and we were left
with... Listen to that bag.
No,
that's
stop.
Awesome.
So before everything merged into GameStop. But so there was Babbage's etc. and Electronics Boutique. But they all had console games, but then also still had computer games. You could get Windows and Mac stuff in there. So you'd have all the displays side by side of basically all the platforms. And a lot of times a bigger selection is because it was a dedicated store.
How about Electronics Boutique?
Yeah.
Did you go there?
Yeah.
I mean, that turned into EB Games. EB was always...
I have a receipt for, what is this, Nintendo pre-owned... What year is this? 94? $14.99. Also, I've got an Egghead software receipt.
Egghead.
Crossroads, Boulevard, and Cary. There is a store there.
Go to
Max Tour 13, 1.3 gigabyte hard drive for $200.
Yeah.
nice.
And a PC gamepad for $20.99. That was a Gravis. There's a Toys R Us. Oh, this is the one. This is an interesting receipt. Toys R Us has Kirby's Adventure for $10 for the NES. That was a great deal. And I got Final Fantasy III at the same time for $61.99.
It's not a bad price.
Yeah, gaming was expensive.
May 14th, 1995.
In the early 90s.
And they've got this stamp that says taken, you know, once you go to the security and you pick it up.
Yeah.
So you can't get it twice.
Right.
Hey.
Babbage's was great, though. This is kind of getting less retro, but during the PlayStation era, they carried Saturn import software for a while. It was just I don't know how they ended up with it, but there were like all kinds of games, like the Konami MSX collection for Saturn, the Shinobi game by Vic Tokai. I even saw Radiant Silver Gun, and I went back to buy it the next day, and it was gone. $50 for Radiant Silver Gun. I screwed up. I blew
it. It's worth like $1,000 now.
It's not worth that much, but it's like $150, $200.
Yeah, it would have been good to get.
It would have.
Reminds me, I bought a copy of Bonk's Adventure on the NES.
Do you still have that?
Yeah, it's like pristine.
Really?
Like I have everything complete. That's worth... It's worth like $1,000 now.
Probably like $1,500 in great condition complete.
Yeah, it's complete.
That one's...
Because I got it when I was older and I kept everything together and didn't smash the box, you know? So it's...
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my most...
Nicely done.
I also got Final Fight Guy from Blockbuster. I used to buy their pre-owned games a lot. And that's worth... You know, I've got the box and the game, but no manual.
Oh, so I need to borrow that from you to photograph.
Oh, really?
That's
cool. I'll bring it over, but... This is something interesting I found in my old receipts, which is Game Genie supplemental codes. Do you remember this? They had these in stores in a little pad that looked like a note, like those peel-off.
I think I saw some of those, yeah.
Peel-off notepads that have a glue top, and then you peel off a paper. And so they were always updating. Like, it says, here they are, your hot Game Genie codes for Mortal Kombat game. That's what it says, for Mortal Kombat game. And it's an update, you know, because it wasn't in the code booklet for the Game Genie.
They should have done those like those like phone number tear offs that people would do on college campuses. Yeah.
Like I need a drummer.
Instead of putting a phone number, put like here's a Game Genie code. Pull it off and take it
rip
home.
Rip it off.
That'd be awesome.
Yep. Well, that was at Kmart. I got a lot of stuff at Kmart.
Yeah, those Kmart. You know, before the NES era, before Babbage's and Electronics Boutique. I remember video games being sold mostly either in department stores or in like dedicated electronic TV shops in malls.
Yeah.
Like there were these
electronic shop. Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's nothing like that anymore. I don't know when they died out exactly, but you would go in and it would just be like a wall of televisions and, you know, novelty.
Like
electronics.
Circuit City or
anything? No.
Just
like
a small shop?
Very, very small. Like basically like enough room for you to walk in and there'd be, you know, a cabinet and a desk on one side.
We just had Radio Shack. That was about
this didn't sell stuff like, you know, the little fidgety diodes and stuff as Radio Shack did. It was just like TVs and stereo components and like kind of high end stuff. I'm sure it was very expensive at the time. But then they would get like, wow, we got the new Atari system. Check it out. And they'd have it on display.
Yeah, did you ever have that in the mall where at North Hills, back when it was an indoor mall, they had these software stores would pop up for a while and they would put the hottest games in the window playing on a monitor. You know, that's where I first saw Prince of Persia on the NVGA or something.
We had a Walden Software.
Oh, Walden,
The video game spinoff of video game, but software spinoff of Walden Books.
Yep. Yeah, I remember Walden Software.
They were always overpriced, but then they would, like, because they were overpriced, stock didn't sell very quickly there. So once things kind of reached end of life, you could find good prices on closeout software. I got Mega Man there way after it was out of print, like right before Mega Man 2 came out, just a couple of months before Mega Man 2 came out. Like no one else had it. And they had just marked it down from like $60 to $25. So I bought it and was like, oh, this game's great, even though it has a terrible cover. They sometimes had like import Game Boy games and all kinds of weird stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking, I wrote a little story about my earliest game buying memory.
Right, tell us your story, Uncle Binge. Don't die. Don't die with the wrestler burglar.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Anyway.
Spider-Man, you know, Uncle Binge.
Okay, sorry. Just the J threw me off there. Anyway, so.
You'd be used to it by now. It's in your name.
Yeah, but I'm not Ben. Like, Ben and Binge are completely different things in my mind. That's the funny thing. You know, there's like, it might as well be Peter and Rob or something. You know, that's the way I think about it. Anyway, earliest computer game buying memory. My dad was a sort of a train nut, and every weekend he would take us to a local train yard to watch freight trains because it was just a hobby. You know, his dad did it with him and he was interested in the machinery. But on the way back, we'd stop by a store called Chips and Bits, which was on Atlantic Avenue, I think. And I always think of it when I drive by there. It's like, oh my gosh, that's where that awesome software store. And we went there one day. We just got an Atari ST. It was probably like 1987. And my brother picked out Ultima 3. Exodus. And that was just so exciting. I was like, all these games, you can buy them? They're in boxes? You can take them home? You can, you know, like, why don't we buy all of them? You know, that's what I was asking. You know? But I must have, this must be before Exodus, because I remember, I remember thinking, like, why don't we get more of these games? You know, why do we only have one? Why are we only buying one?
Weren't you
these,
like two, you know, when Exodus came out?
Yeah, well, Exodus, the ST port, you know.
Oh, maybe that was later. Okay.
Yeah. Whenever the original Exodus came out, maybe, but, you know, this is 87. So I don't know if I would be saying that stuff when I was six, but I just remember getting Exodus there and it was just a really special place. So it's funny how that resonates with me it's sort of a special place in the city just because I have that memory there every time I drive by that place. So it means a lot to us gamers.
I think probably one of my first like impulse purchases, like I'm looking at my list of old games and like, I mean, the first things I got was I'd saved up my own allowance to, you know, to get my NES. And that was about the time Super Mario 2 was coming out. So I had to get that because obviously Mario. But I think one of the first thing I like impulse purchased was Clash at Demon Head, which that worked out pretty well. Yeah. Like it had this cool box and it was kind of inscrutable to me as a young child, but it's got a lot in there. I think I may have drawn some maps for that too, because it needs them.
It does.
Yeah. I have another small story. Do we have time?
We do, but then we have to wind this one down because I know you have things to do.
Yeah, I gotta go.
You should do Clash of Demon Head mapping like you did.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Right. I just remember just the excitement of being a kid and hearing about games secondhand. Well, I feel like it was around Halloween in whatever year it was, 88 or something. This one kid in our neighborhood had Super Mario Brothers 2. And I feel like I had never even seen it at that time in a magazine or anything. And we were like so excited. We all had to go to his house and play it. And his dad, they said like his dad had bought it on a business trip somewhere else and brought it back. And he had it first in the whole city. And I was like, I talked about that at Blaster Master when we ordered Blaster Master. And it wasn't even at any retail stores locally. And we had it first. And that actually meant something. Like it was a cachet among the kids in the neighborhood, you know, it was a cool thing. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, shortages and scarcity was a thing for Nintendo even back then. I remember I got Ninja Gaiden when it first came out for NES, and my aunt worked at a warehouse at Best Products, and so she was able to pick it up it came into the storeroom. Mm-hmm. And when she picked it up, like one of her coworkers said, "Hey, can I borrow that from him when he's done?" Because like he hadn't been able to find a copy for himself.
Going to see other people's games was definitely a thing. Like I remember one of the things I would do all the time as a kid was go over to my friend's house to see Final Fantasy. I wasn't even really, I hadn't got into RPGs at that point yet. I don't even know what was up with this, but he had it and would play it and I would go.
It was a beautiful game too. Yeah. Like I couldn't believe the graphics for Final Fantasy. We had a friend who had that. The first time I saw Super Mario Brothers was before we even had an NES in my family, and we went to a friend's house, and it just blew me away.
So I don't know how universal this episode has been compared to the arcade ones, where we were kind of, you know, getting other people's opinions and speaking more in general terms. But I think there is value in, hopefully, these recollections and anecdotes. I'm sure some of them have been mentioned before on the show, but that's okay. Hopefully people enjoyed listening to this. If not, well, in a couple of days, there'll be another episode of Retronauts and you can listen to that instead. So thanks for bearing with us. And Ben and Benj, thank you for your opinions and memories.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Indeed.
Fantastic. So this has been Retronauts Micro. I have been Jeremy Parrish. That has been Ben, and that has been Benj.
Benj.
So I don't even know where we're going with this. But yes, you can hear more Retronauts podcasts if you enjoyed this one, or even if you didn't, at retronauts.com, on iTunes, on the Podcast One Network, and the Podcast One app. And if you want to help make this podcast happen month to month, week to week, you can support us through Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts. That is how this podcast happens. We travel, we record, we buy equipment, we play video games, we talk about stuff.
You give me gin.
And I have to pay for Benj's gin, yes. So, Benj, why don't you tell us about yourself?
I don't know. I'm a freelance journalist and historian, technology, video games, computers. And you can read my work at vintagecomputing.com. And I have a Patreon, patreon.com/BenjEdwards. Ben?
I'm looking for a job. Anyone need a C++ programmer?
I do.
Aside from that, you can find me at Kieran on Twitter, KIRINN, and at Kieran's Retro Closet on Tumblr. That's Kieran with one N that time. And I'll try to put up some stuff relevant to this episode by the time it goes up there. So you can probably see some old old maps and manuals or something. We'll see what I can find.
Sounds good. All right. And you can find me on Twitter, yes, as GameSpite. And he's not here, but you can find my co-host Bob at Bob Servo on Twitter, because you should follow him too. So yes, that wraps it up for this Retronauts Micro. We'll be back, like I said, in a few days with another full episode, and 2 weeks from now with another micro episode. Look forward to it.